When we come to understand something of the providence of God, we know that the Christian life is not a life of pacifism or being passive. It's about understanding that God is at work and God is working in and through everything, but we are called to be co-workers with him. And so what we discover in this passage are a few interesting things, especially from verses 6 down through that for a few verses. If you just take a little bit of time, we want to think of this because it brings us to what may well be regarded as the first formal, as it were, entrance in a strategic way, planned way, by one of God's missionaries into what we call Europe today. Of course, that's all. Those terms, Europe and geographical locations, are all very dated in time. So, but for our understanding, we do see something of that here. And as we think about the Apostle Paul and those that are with him, really actively trying to proclaim the gospel, as it says, that they were wanting to speak the word, we read in this very strange thing in verses 6 and 7 of doors that are closing. Doors that are closing. And the doors are closing not by their own choice, but they're being closed by the Lord himself. And of course, he closes some doors because he has purpose to open other doors. But when we read that they were forbidden by the Holy Spirit, how that came about, we don't know. You'd like to talk to the Apostle Paul. How did you sense that you were forbidden? It's quite a strong statement. And then again in verse 7, we read that the Spirit of Jesus did not allow them to go. And here they have got an earnest intention to go to preach the gospel, and they're said, no, I don't want you to preach the gospel there. And so that is followed by visions that are appearing in verses 8 to 9. So they move on from there. They go to Troas, and we read in verse 9 that a vision appeared to Paul in the night. A man of Macedonia was standing there, urging him and saying, come over to Macedonia and help us. Of course, quite often when things don't happen the way that we want, if we don't remember things like this, we get frustrated and annoyed and disappointed, unless we're reminded that there must be a bigger story going on. We ought not to react in the wrong way when things don't go the way that we want. It's a good lesson for all of life, isn't it? When things happen to us, whatever those things may be that we're not particularly happy with, we need to stop and think, no, I don't react in the wrong way. I should be humble, grateful, thankful, and trusting. And so God then speaks to the Apostle Paul what this vision was like. We don't know. All we know is what we're told. We certainly know there was something very clear because it had the impact and the effect upon his life that he turned his focus and his direction away from Asia Minor and moved entirely in a new direction completely. And so we have, thirdly there, we have guidance that is confirming. For Paul, we read there, when he had seen the vision, he immediately sought to go on to Macedonia, concluding that God had called us to preach to them. So when they sit down and they think about the set of circumstances that are going on around their lives, they work out and they say, we think God is in this. He wants us to go in this other direction. He wants us to get a boat, go across the little bit of sea, and we will find ourselves wherever it's there. So the guidance confirms to him. And we read in verse 11, they set sail from Troas, and they make a direct voyage to Samothrace, and the following day to Neapolis, and from there to Philippi, which is the leading city of the district of Macedonia and a Roman colony. Like Luke, with all this historical detail, all those things that someone who likes history loves to see. You can follow it, you can trace it, you can get a sense of what it must have been like. And then it takes us here, fourthly, to a strategy that is directing them. A strategy that is directing them. You think about the Apostle Paul, he doesn't do things in any haphazard way. As you follow the pattern of his ministry and his missionary journeys, 1, 2, and 3, through the Acts of the Apostles as they are recorded for us, you can sense there's a very clear pattern in the way he does things. He's like a man who sits down and has thinking time and praying time and then working it out and getting the map out and strategizing where he should go and where are the main centers of population, where are the strategic cities, what would be the most significant place to go to. We know how he went originally to the Jewish communities, and then whenever the doors closed to the Jewish communities, turns to the Gentiles. And he continues with this strategy. And what we see in this here in verses 11, 12, 13, and following through the rest of that section, it's all about a strategy that directs his behavior. He goes to the main city, and then when he goes to the main city, he does a little bit of reconnaissance. He spends, it says there at the end of verse 12, we remained in the city some days. I don't think he just hung out in the coffee shops. I think he was out and about and engaging and looking and investigating. We get from when he was in Athens that he had checked out just about every location and been able to say, I've seen all the idols, I've even seen one to an unknown God, I've seen everything. So that he was able to report that when he went to the Areopagus. It became the foundation of his ministry that particular day. And I think it's most likely fair to say that he was observing, he was listening, he was taking in, he was like a missionary detective, you could say. And he was seeing everything. And then comes on the Sabbath day, we read that he went outside the gate to the riverside where he supposed there was a place of prayer. If there had been a synagogue, he would have found it. 10 adult male Jewish people would have meant you could have had a synagogue. There mustn't have been as many as that in that city, so no synagogue. So he will imagine the only other place where they're going to be gathering will be on the Sabbath day because they're Jews, and it will be outside the city. It'll be at a place of water which was significant for them, and that's his pattern. And when he goes there, he then starts to, actually the word is not that he taught that day, he did not teach, he laleoed, he spoke, he just chatted to them. It wasn't really like a sermon, I don't think, that day. It was he really had conversation with them. It says, we sat down and we spoke to the woman who had come together. Only woman. And so he just chats to them. What did that involve? We don't know. He talked, maybe he asked questions. I have no doubt that he asked questions to inquire what they understood, what they believed. And then we read that the Lord opened the heart of one woman whose name was Lydia. And she was baptized. Don't know whether it was that very same day. We don't know. It could well have been in the mission of the gospel. You don't see an awful lot of time. It's not a massive time between conversion and baptism. Catechizing, certainly, but it's not this long years that sometimes we see. And so he then finds she is a woman who is welcome to open her home and household, and she draws them in there. And that becomes the first church, formally we could say, maybe, in this mission development. Now, there may well have been other churches, because we know that following Pentecost, there were people there from various parts of the whole of the empire. Now, it does not record that any of them were outside of Asia Minor or the Palestinian section. We don't read of anything there in Acts 2 of people over in Rome and so forth, but people traveled very widely. People were in business, and people moved along the great Roman roads that had been designed for fast movement of armies to keep the peace in the empire. And it's highly likely that some of those Christians who came to faith at Pentecost would have gone out and would have taken their faith into all of the various parts of the Roman Empire. Whether they formed churches, it's highly, we don't know, we can't say for sure. You can conjecture, but I have no idea. Therefore, we might say, is this the first European church? Now, we know that the Turkish nation would like to join the European Union. Some want out at the other end, some want in at the other end. It's a, you know, it's whatever. But they're not there yet, so we can't say that it's Europe yet. Whether it ever will be is another question. But as I was thinking about this and the way my mind works, I started to think about the nature of the church. Certainly, we see how the church is formed through the closing of doors and the appearing of visions and the confirming of guidance and the directing through strategy. But what's it like in there? From other passages, as you go in and kind of think your way into some of those, you discover interesting things. And this is very relevant for what I want to say in a few minutes. But in 2 Timothy 4, there's a kind of a list of greetings that the Apostle Paul gives. And he's wanting to pass on these greetings. and I just mentioned one or two of them, but I just see what you make of this. Paul's writing, and obviously this is about AD 64, 65. So this is about 15 or 16 years later from Acts chapter 16. So there's a period of about that length of time. And in Paul's final remarks in his final letter, which is to Timothy in Ephesus, he's then saying, do your best to come to me soon, for Demas, in love with this present world, has deserted me and gone to Thessalonica. So Demas is not really part of the storyline in that sense of the church. He's gone off to Thessalonica, not because he wants to start church or serve church, but because he's fallen in love with the present world. But Crescens has gone to Galatia, Titus to Dalmatia, Luca's with him. And then he says, Tychicus I've sent to Ephesus. And he speaks about at least three different places, and he may even speak about Trophimus. He has left him, yes, at the end, if you read on down into verse 20. Erastus remained at Corinth. I left Trophimus, who was ill at Miletus. Now, the way my mind works when I read that is maybe a bit obtuse, but it's the way I think. When I read all of those things, what I see is something really exciting. I see something of the picture of the church underneath this little bit of detail that the Apostle Paul is giving, which is merely greetings, I know. He's telling us something about the spread of the church and the relationship of the church, one part to the other part. The same is true if you take 1 and 2 Peter. Peter is writing to the churches that are in Asia, and he's writing from Rome, and he's most likely writing a little bit around the same time, AD 63, 64, because he's writing just about the time of the Nero's persecutions, and that's just after the burning of Rome. And he is sending his letter to a large part of Asia, circular letters. And Ephesus, the letter, Ephesians, letter to the Ephesians, it may be, it may not be a circular letter, but it has been argued that it is a circular letter. And when you read the little pastoral epistle of the Ephesians, you realize that it's not about specific problems in Ephesus necessarily. It's about great truths that every Christian should know about. And then again, when you read in Jude's little epistle, it may be to Jewish believers in Egypt, Asia Minor, or Antioch. And if you add into that the sense of the revelation speaking to the seven churches, which is written in such a fashion as though you're going to go on a journey around that area, you get a sense that in the church as it is developing, there's what we might call an amazing sense of community or interconnectedness. They're all known. It's a little bit like when you go away from Northern Ireland. You know that sort of feeling? And you go to different parts of the world and you meet somebody and they say, oh, where are you from? Well, I'm from Northern Ireland. Oh, do you know such and such? And very, very soon you'll find you've got some sort of connection somewhere. It's this sense of connectedness that we seem to have wherever we travel. But I think that's what we discover here in the New Testament with the early church. A sense of interconnectedness of the church. It's working together, it's serving together, and they are aware of each other. You know that it's very possible to be in the same town along with other churches and be totally, absolutely unaware of anything happening in them. Isn't that right? I'm in Portrush. I might as well be in another planet sometimes. I realize that from what's happening, 50 miles down the road. We easily can get so absorbed in where we are and what we're doing. And it's understandable because there's focus and ministry and that's there. But in order to try to help us understand something about the encouragement that comes from being interconnected and the need for it and the blessing that comes through it, I want to tell you the story of an organization that I'm a part of, which is really, it seems to me, to reflect something of what we see here in Paul in his first church and in the Europe, and also the churches generally throughout that period of the church history. When I think of ELF, which I want to talk about, the European Leadership Forum, as late as the end, as we can now speak like this, as late as the end of the last millennium, which is only 18 years ago, some Christian leaders were working in the newly linked up Europe. So Europe has already kind of, the Iron Curtain has come down, we've got all these new nations have joined, the European Union has expanded and expanded, and you've got all this great freedom, and people are traveling who've not been able to travel across borders. But what one or two Christians who were involved in ministry in Europe discovered was just this sense of isolation that existed there. People in their own denomination, in their own geographical area, unaware of the big world outside of them. Many of the problems they had, they didn't realize that there would be answers to those problems not very far away. A train journey, maybe, or a couple of train journeys, or at least a few hours travel, but totally accessible, totally available, but totally unknown about. Isolation leads to what? Well, you know what it's like. You can look at it. It's in a whole other area to think of it in different spheres. But isolation often leads to a narrowing of one's thinking. You begin to, your thinking gets smaller and smaller, as it were. Inward looking. We've heard about discouragement tonight, and it does lead to discouragement. Isolation is a way to become discouraged. And at its worst, isolation leads to cynicism. We've met people like that. And we've sometimes met churches like that. In earlier times, the transfer of ideas throughout Europe came with trade and commerce. Across the European scene, people like William Tyndale, Jan Hus, in the 15th century, ideas, Reformation ideas, were circulating with trade. The Dutch, in their commerce and influence, were very influential in Reformation England, where they used the trade routes, sending Bibles, literature, pamphlets, people. And so this great sense of interconnectedness was going on and was having a profound effect upon the whole state of the church at significant times in the history of Europe. Maybe in the earlier period of the last century, following the First and Second Wars, we then had the Cold War. We have this Iron Curtain that appears. And if you traveled it back in those days, my first visit was in 1977 to an IFES conference that took place in Austria because of its location so close, as you can see there, to the Czech, Slovak, and Hungarian areas. And there were Christians who came from Zagreb and from then Czechoslovakia and from Ukraine and different places. And we talked and we discovered we were all students together. And I remember just thinking about this, how they were separated. They went back home. And they'd only been able to get there because of some special sets of circumstances that, from educational purposes or whatever else. Maybe the Iron Curtain, you know, did create disconnectedness within the church. There's no doubt. If you were growing up within some of the countries behind that Iron Curtain, you were certainly not allowed to communicate outside that. And if you did, you could risk all sorts of things. But I think that these types of things created physical and also actual barriers that separated believers. 1989, we know the Iron Curtain or the Berlin Wall came down, which symbolized the breaking down of those barriers. And we know that then there's been lots of change and travel and so on. But when 2001, some Christians met together, they discovered that what would then be around 12 years 11, 12 years after the breakdown of the Iron Curtain, the sense of disconnectedness was just as real. Yes, people were traveling. Short-term mission trips were plenty. I've been involved in them myself. But there wasn't really, there were questions, there were issues, there were problems that were there and were not being answered by that type of ministry or that type of mission. And so, at the end of that period, and even looking at it presently, it's interesting to see the state of Europe. I think this is important as well to think about it. You may not realize we will always be in Europe, whether we're part of the European Union or not. That's another question. And for this benefit of statistics, it's just interesting to see where we stand in the European League. You might be shocked to see where we stand. Actually, I think I'll tell you that people who claim no religion in the United Kingdom is 67% of the population. I think there's a slide maybe coming up that'll maybe say something. It might be, that just tells you what a lot of churches are like in Europe. Pretty empty. That's the traditional mainline churches. Maybe I know in certain parts there's a revival of religion in some parts, but generally speaking, in many parts of Europe, my experience in traveling over the last 25 years in lots of different parts and talking with Christians is that the mainline congregations and denominations are shrinking. Some other parts are changing. But in this slide, it's really giving ideas about... I have to get close to it. I just want to see UK again. UK is down at the very bottom. The bottom line is, I can give you a little, if you're interested, I've got a bigger map, a bigger thing here, a bigger chart, which I can read actually for myself. But what's really shocking to realize is that people who have no religion, claiming no religion, 91% in the Czech Republic. That's what four decades of communism did in the Czech Republic. And Estonia, 80% claim no religion. Sweden, big Lutheran states, 75%. The Netherlands, 72%. And Britain is standing at 70%. I mean, you can go all the way down. I want to see what Slovenia. Slovenia is 37%, 38%. Some countries like Poland is like 17% because it's a very strongly Roman Catholic country. But what does that compute to really in real terms? People have a sense of an identification. It's their identity. Their religion is their identity, but it's not a real living faith for so many people in Europe. Even in Ireland, we know that's the case. I'll give you what Ireland is here. Ireland is 39% of people in Ireland in this survey said they had no religion. Well, we know that's quite accurate. We can see that in the referendums that have happened in the last few years in the south of Ireland. So it's against that backdrop. And you can look at, this is a Pew survey here. There's other ones. There's lots of surveys that come out of looking at the state of things in Europe. And they are all saying the same thing, that Europe is post-Christian. So when this sense of disconnectedness was discovered, there were a few people that thought we should do something about it. And the lovely thing is that God raises up individuals in the history of the church. And he's been doing that right from the very beginning. The Apostle Paul is an illustration. There are many other individuals he raised up. And he does something with individuals. And there is a place for the individual at a strategic time to do something. And one man had this burden in his heart to think about this. And he got together with a few other Christian leaders in the European context. And so he brought together someone from UCCF, that's the student world, Universities and Colleges Christian Fellowship, someone from the Christian Medical Fellowship, the Swedish Evangelical Alliance, Labri, and the Zacharias Trust. There were about five of them. They met in a pub in Oxford. And they sat down and they had a conversation. What could we do to really help? What could we really do to help the situation in Europe where we have so many people who need help, but they're all so disconnected from each other? And so they decided that they would invite 100 people from 20 countries to a special apologetics conference. Now, I'm sure you do know what apologetics are in this congregation, but for those who may be visiting and don't know it, for those who want to understand their faith, defend their faith, or proclaim their faith, that's the way I think is simply to put it. Helping people understand so that they can communicate proclaim and defend their faith. And so they got 100 people from 20 countries to come. And then they decided to invite 200, and they got 200 from 25 countries to come. And they extended it from apologetics to include theology, Bible teaching, and counseling and education. That was in 2003. Last year, the European Leadership Forum had to be capped at 800. Maybe 200 people were not able to be invited because they just didn't have room for them capacity, literally. 800 people from 40 countries and 28 networks, which then computes in a year all round for while we meet for 5 days, and we can move a slide on one or two, it's fine. You'll just get at least, yeah, don't worry, these are, there we are. We'll leave that one up. That's fine. Leave it there. Thank you very much. That computes to 860 events, partnerships going on within the European context. And what we do is people only come by either invitation or recommendation. So it's not just a free-for-all. The idea is this is a kind of a strategic way to look at the situation. So there are people from all these different countries who are strategic in their part and place within the church nationally in that country. And there are others who will be able to recommend them, who know the situation, who can say, yes, this person would be brilliant to go there. And then they link in with one of the networks, and they have 5 days of intensive ministry, training, and investment by others. Those who come to help are, I could not begin to give you the list of those who come, but it is really a list of all the leading evangelicals throughout the world who come to give their time in every one of these areas. And the key thing is, they give it free. Nobody gets paid to go to ELF. Everybody pays their own way. So whether you're the main speaker or whether you're somebody else in some other level, we all invest our time, we invest our resources in order to give it to those who've come to spend that time there. And that's quite radical in the Western world, where everybody's thinking about honorariums and expenses and all the rest of it. And it's very healthy. And it's a wonderful way to see it. So I think it's been also a key part of it, because it means that we come together, as it were, to give all the time. When people come together, then they can, you don't just simply come for 5 days, but then we try to encourage everybody to sign up to a year-round mentoring program of one sort or another. At present, I've been leading the Introductory Apologetics Network and began another network with a friend who happens to be Brethren, which shows you how we cross all the boundaries denominationally, which is very healthy. And he and I have established a young pastors network as well. And we try to get people to come on a year-round mentoring program where they will work intensively with us on webinars, which are, for those of you not familiar, seminars on the internet, and where we bring them together for special times of teaching at some part and place in Europe at strategic times throughout the year. We give them one-on-one mentoring. Tomorrow morning I'll be having mentoring time with a young pastor from the Czech Republic in Prague. And we will continue this for a year, and then we hope that they will find them, move them on to something else. So it's a way of really helping strategically people who were once disconnected to become connected. Now, of course, you say, well, what happens? The stories are multiple. I cannot tell you all the stories of the people that come, but I spent last weekend in London with a church, a young pastor that came onto our young pastors network, and I would mentor him, and so I went over to spend some time with him and his small church, 30 people, ranging between the ages of 20 and 35, not a baby in sight, one marriage so far, and they meet just down the side of Leicester Square in another little church that they rent space for 5 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon. Last weekend, we had 20 different people from 7 nationalities, several non-believers at the church's weekend away. A young man who's being mentored, who's been helped and encouraged through the work of ELF, and going back into London, working in a very strategic place in the centre of London. with the vision to plant churches and to serve God and to see the gospel grow. People are linking in from every one of the 40 countries that we connect with throughout the European context. It is a wonderful message, I think, that's going forth from this, and in a very strange way, because it's not like something you say, well, tell me what's happening. I'd say it's multiplicity of things that are happening. The stories in so many people's lives, including my own life as well, that went there, first of all, just to sit and learn and so on, and eventually has ended up in this role, which is a blessing and a privilege. And I'm constantly trying to encourage people from our own church to go. Our present moderator actually went last year. Dr. McMullen was there last year at it. At least we've had three or four former moderators have found their way to it. But we really love to get some who are not just at that stage in their lives. We'd like to get some who are kind of, you know, at different stages. This year I've managed to get funding for a number of people from this part of the world to go, and so I'm really hoping that there might be people who might even think about this, strategic people in congregations and in churches that we can take there, encourage, develop, and see them transplanted back and encouraged to develop on in ministry where they are. So what is the challenge for us and the encouragement? Well, I think the whole challenge is that comes from Paul's word is that because he was a man who was active, understanding the providences of God and understanding the working of God, being willing to push every door until it opens for him, and having that vision to continue to proclaim the gospel with a strategic mental attitude, thinking strategically, but working constantly. And that's my encouragement for you tonight, is to think strategically. ELF is one of those things that is there to help a person think strategically about their life and ministry. And I would commend it to your prayers and also commend it to you to consider, maybe there's some way in which God might want you to be a part of that. Maybe you might want to help fund people to go to it, or you may want to access it for yourself. And I'd be very happy to help steer you in that direction, or through your church particularly. Let me pray for us.